Let's start with how the Houthis evolved. The Houthis somehow have been always able to work on different tracks in their the political movement, let's say, or as an insurgency. They work as a social movement. In fact, it started as a revivalist movement, a Zaydi revivalist movement, early on in the 90s, and then it, from there it branched out into an armed insurgency. But the social movement is still part of the group one way or another. A third track, in addition to their armed insurgency hat, is the political, formal political hat, basically. They were engaged in party politics. In the 90s, they formed a party, a small party, Al-Haq. Hussein Al-Houthi, who was the leader of the Houthi movement, was a parliament member at that time, and they also joined the opposition against Saleh in something called the Joint Members Party in the 2000s, just before the uprising. And so they were also engaged in that political dimension, and also they were very active in the National Dialogue Conference, which followed the transitional period after the 2011 uprising and the brokered deal that was quite short before we slipped into conflict. So it's important to understand that the Houthis are multidimensional, and they use these different hats in quite creative ways. At the moment, and I want to also talk about their motivations and goals in the midterm, short to midterm, and also in the long term. Although for the long term, I will not kind of project too much, because I think they can evolve as we go, and I don't want to say too much about their long-term goals more than what they already state. But for the short and midterm, we have seen that they were for a long time a domestic group. They had domestic issues. They were very much part of that domestic context in Yemen. As I said, during Saleh's time, through their work as a social movement, and then their insurgency period, and a long period of war with the regime in the 2000s that started 2003 and ended 2010, just before the uprising, and then the integration into the 2011 squares and revolution and all that. At the moment, what they're doing is three things. They're working on three theaters. One is the domestic, and I will explain exactly how they're doing that now in their current kind of power position. And then also with the regional and international opponents, foes, and then regionally with their friends. Basically the other groups that are aligned with Iran and that share an alignment in ideology. Domestically, the Houthis are acting like a state in some parts. They govern a population in a very strict manner, and they are able to control the part that they're holding. And they control basically something like 60 to 70% of the population. It's a little bit difficult to determine exactly the percentage because they moved a lot and there's a lot of IDPs, but let's say around 60 to 70% of the population. And in terms of territory, it's a smaller territory than the other groups that control the east and the southern parts. But the population is significant. Their tactics basically are extractive. They extract a lot from the population in terms of taxes. They are very effective tax collectors. And they don't give anything in return for the taxes that they extract from a population that is already quite in a dire situation. So this creates a relationship that it's quite unique, because to do this you need to really use all your oppressive tools to be able to do that, and they use that to the maximum. They also engage in surveillance in quite advanced ways, and rumor has it is that they learned a lot of these methods from Hezbollah. Of course, Hezbollah was an important mentor for the Houthis, and they provided a lot of technical support and advice. But they also took control of the public institutions when they entered and captured the capital, Sana'a. And when they did that, of course, they took also control of all the intelligence files and so on from the former regime. So they have a wealth of data that can allow them to surveil the population in a very strict manner. And they use new technologies to do that as well. They also induce fear among populations. So now it is very, very risky to say anything. If they dig out an old Facebook post or a Twitter post or something like this, you can disappear. They have been engaging in mass arrests, mass detentions, especially in the past few months, but from before. But since May, basically, they detained something like 20 UN staff, including someone from the UN envoy's office. So the person who's supposed to be mediating, one of his staff was detained. And they are still disappeared. They were able to contact their families once, and some of them couldn't. No one knows where they are. There is no legal process that started. And since then, there have been also televised confessions with some of the people who have been detained from earlier on, kind of confessing to being a part of an espionage network and also naming some of the collaborators who are people that we know very well from the civil society and other intellectuals. So there is a sort of a purge, a cultural purge in society to put anyone who has been working with any, let's say, UN or Western body, or who had been educated outside of the country, to put them on the spot. This is coming with a social stigma on the families of people who have also been part of this, because they're being accused of being, you know, connected to a spy. So this is a little bit different than previous political prisoners who, you know, people usually sympathize with their families and so on. This is very different. And finally, they reject completely to engage with any Yemeni political opponent or rival. They don't recognize anyone else. And of course, they accuse them of being puppets to the Saudis or the Emiratis. Or so. And maybe there's a case there. But this also tells us that they're not willing to engage with any Yemeni rival. And so this brings us to an idea that they always like to present, which is this quest for sovereignty. From a context of non-sovereignty, basically, Yemen is completely, you know, open to so many parties, and the Houthis are also very, very aligned, you know, very close to the Iranians. They receive support from them, so they are not completely independent, let's say. And so there is this tension between sovereignty and non-sovereignty that they are playing with. And they justify a lot of this approach that they are using as part of enforcing a notion of sovereignty. In terms of their goals internationally and regionally with their opponents, number one, they want to, you know, they have reached the point where they were able to make their opponents lose all appetite to combat them, to fight them. So the Saudis no longer want to engage in any military activity with against the Houthis. They have been completely consumed by a 10-year of military operation that has become a failure. And they are relying on this as a way of pressuring these opponents to concede to their demands and so on. Of course, we know that there are huge economic projects that Saudi is trying to put forward within its 2030 vision. And the Houthis know that this is a very sensitive spot for the Saudis. They of course, did a lot of drone and missile attacks across the border, and this really scared the Saudis because they felt that their economic assets were at risk and the stakes were too high. And so they decided to go into another track with the Houthis, which is, let's end this war, let's get out, and let's make sure that we can secure the country so that we can continue with our economic aspirations. And so this loss of appetite to combat them is something that the Houthis are worked towards, and they are exploiting now to the maximum. And in terms of what they're doing now in the Red Sea is that they're basically antagonizing the international community in various ways, in very obvious ways, but still relying on the idea that the Saudis don't want to go into war with them anymore, and so they will have their back indirectly. And we can get into some examples here on how this was done in specific ways. And then finally, the third track, which is regionally with their friends, let's say. And this is basically where it becomes very clear that they have strategically tried to graduate from that domestic position to a regional actor. And if, you know, if we look at this trajectory, which is not a very long period, where they were really confined in Saada in the north of Yemen, and then advanced to the capital Sana'a, and then tried to advance a bit to the south, but were pushed back, and now they are a regional actor to reckon with. And what they did basically is something that is quite characteristic of them, which is that they turn a challenge into an opportunity. And I don't say this because I'm a fan in any way, but because this is something that we should acknowledge. They are playing the long game. They are strategic, while all their rivals are not, including Saudi Arabia. They all lack strategy and vision. But we see that the Houthis have a vision, and they play the long game. They are willing to wait and use strategic patience, as was mentioned earlier in the day, to prove a point. And so what happened is that now with the Gaza, the 7 October, the Gaza war, and the attack on Hezbollah, on the Hezbollah leadership in particular, they, although this hit them very strongly because they're very close to Hezbollah, and as I said, they are their mentors, and it's also a very personal relationship, and this was a big hit for them, I think, at the, not only at the level of kind of brothers in arms, but also personally to Abdul Malik al-Houthi, who was very close to Hassan Nasrallah. But they saw that here there's something, that there's an opportunity for them to really show their credentials, not only to Iran, but also to their peers within what, for lack of other words, we call the axis of resistance, or proxies, or we can talk about these names later, but I think it's a matter of perspective and function of the use of words. But here we see very clearly that first they very quickly moved into this Red Sea campaign shortly after the 7 October. So the first initial attacks were just 10 days later. And then in November, they launched the formal campaign. And this campaign has been going up. The attacks fluctuate, but it's quite high intensity, I would say. And this has led to almost a halving of the traffic in the Red Sea has gone down to half. And countries like Egypt and so on have been hit very badly by this economically. And so they know exactly that this is a very sensitive sector. A small drone hitting and maybe targeting and not really hitting whatever can create a lot of havoc in a commercial sector that is very sensitive, where insurance companies charge very high premiums if there is this type of risk, and this kind of puts a whole sector in a sensitive situation. But it also creates other alternative routes that can become permanent, and it can change the region in a very radical way if it continues for a long time. But they understood this sensitivity, and they really tapped on it. In a country that has no naval force, although Yemen is on a long coast, but naval force is non-existent. And it also tells us that they have been working on this for a long period before 7 October, and there has been some attacks in the Red Sea before that, and also a use of, for example, the Safir tanker that was holding oil and was risking an environmental crisis. And so they already tested this situation before, and when the opportunity came, they quickly jumped on it. But we also see that they are trying to present themselves also as an added value to the cause, in the sense that they can have an important role in the Horn of Africa and in the African continent. And we've seen this in very close collaborations with the Shabab. And this also tells us about how the Shia group, the bridging between the Shia and the Sunni groups is there. There is an idea that is transnational, that is pan-Islamist, and that crosses the borders and even ideologies. And with al-Shabaab, it's not just a convenient exchange, but it is really a collaboration. There have been high-level visits to al-Shabaab from the Houthi leaders. Beyond that, we are also witnessing commercial and trade exchanges between other groups who are active in the region, non-state actors or whatever we want to call them. And so this is proving utility to Iran and associated groups in a way that I think is very novel. And I think it's, you know, we can see how creative the Houthis are in that front. Now, it still comes back to the idea of sovereignty and non-sovereignty, because they are asserting a notion of sovereignty in a domestic level. They are, you know, they're able to get some kind of recognition from regional and international states, even if not officially, but de facto, in the sense that Saudi Arabia realized that the only way out of this mess that it got itself into in Yemen is to go directly into talks with the Houthis and to concede to Houthi demands, to all of them, actually, and without any reservations. And so this de facto is recognition, even if it's not. And they also stuck to their point that they will not go into talks with other Yemeni rivals. And so this is a way of carving a kind of sovereignty that is, I think, worth studying and understanding its dynamics. And then again, this role that the movement of the group is playing in solidarity with other ideologically aligned groups, and with the idea of this global solidarity for Gaza and for others. And this has also been a very successful PR stunt for them. Because just before 7 October, in September, the month before, the Houthis, up until then, have been enjoying a period of about 1.5 years, something like this, of relative peace. There has been a truce. The front lines have gone somewhat quiet. But then they realized that this is pushing the population to demand more, because there is no more a pretense of war and aggression. And so they can demand services. They want more. And in September, 26th of September, the anniversary of the Republican Revolution, which is seen to be the Republic is by some seen as an antithesis to the Houthis, who some perceive as coming to restore an earlier period of the imamate. And so people went out to the streets in spite of the fear-inducing tactics and the brutal way of the Houthis. They went to the streets and started to demand more. And so there was a lot, and I think this took the Houthis by surprise. And they realized that actually peace is not really working very good for us. Maybe we need something to keep everyone busy all the time. And just in November, they were supposed to go into the agreement with Saudi Arabia. The terms of the agreement have been agreed on, negotiated with the parties, and the UN was informed about it to then take it forward after the Saudis and the Houthis go into the agreement. And this was supposed to be in November. So the Houthis decided that this can all be paused and we can go to the Red Sea and try something else. And that's exactly what they did. And so it worked for them internally, in the sense that they were able to shut down the popular demand for services and basic needs. They were able to shock and surprise Saudi Arabia, that conceded a lot for that agreement and thought that the Houthis will jump on it, because there was a very significant financial aspect to it that was quite controversial. But they also knew that the Saudis will still want to go into that agreement, even if they go and do this adventure in the Red Sea. And so in terms of calculation, I would say this is very effective political calculation. In terms of its relation with Iran and other groups, they have become almost completely, it shows that they have also been very, very much integrated. I mean, and the Houthis are quite distant geographically and in other ways from the groups in Iraq or Hezbollah. And for Iran, it was like really low investment, group that can put pressure on Saudi Arabia when needed. It limits its hegemony in the region. And it worked for its advantage without too much investment. But I don't think they expected more from the Houthis than that. But now that it has become completely integrated in, again, let's say for simplicity purposes, the axis of resistance, is that it is now losing a little bit of its sovereignty that it's continuously trying to negotiate to Iran, because what they are doing now has direct impact on Iranian national interest. And of course, Iran was very much willing to give the Houthis free rein to do whatever they want, as long as it was in the southern Red Sea, in their domestic arena. But now that its own interest is at stake, we see that the Iranians are putting them on a leash in some aspects. And so here they're also, they have indirectly lost some of their autonomy. And I can close here and we can open for
questions. Can we see your slides?
Sure. So this is an afterthought, but this is a caricaturist, a young Yemeni artist. He was quite active during the 2011 uprising, and he's very creative, but now he's full-time working as a caricaturist for the Houthis, and he has a lot of these types of caricatures, and so he put this one in his page, which shows like the Red Sea as the sword of Yemen to fight Israel. Another also way to show how they're quite good in their PR stunts is this guy. I don't know if anyone has seen them, but he was very, he went viral on TikTok and other places. And I think he was then banned from TikTok. But it was the hot pirate. And I would say, like, he beats Arafai or what's his name. This was picked up a lot. And I think he also got a lot of... he got into a bit of trouble about it because he was kind of accused of being a little bit feminine. And then I don't think he's a very famous person or anything like that, but it's also just to show how they are popular all the way to Pakistan and beyond. And so this is a Pakistani tweeter who wrote about this. And if one does really a proper scan on the social media, you'll find from North Africa to East Asia to, of course, Europe and the US. I was sitting yesterday in the airport next to a priest, an Italian priest, and he knew I was Yemeni. He said, "Hey, the Houthis are great because what's happening in Gaza is terrible." And I was like, "What?" So it tells you something, and I mean there are many stories about this, but at least whatever they're doing in terms of propaganda is working in their advantage. And then I also found this yesterday by Mick Wallace, who's kind of making a claim for the Houthis. And then finally wanted to share this. They have this very interesting type of art that's like music called Zawamil. I mean, it's Zawamil means something else, but they have appropriated it for this war music. And they're very kind of high beat, type of songs. They're all like fighting songs. And I heard from an Egyptian friend that her spin class teacher in Egypt plays them in the class. And so they're really all over. And I think this is also worth kind of trying to understand how this happened, because this is a group that, you know, came from the mountains of Saada. And I can close there. Thank you.
Thank you so much.